Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat. Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. Here at the Takshashila Institution, we've been tracking coronavirus updates from across the world fairly closely, as you'll know. One thing that's really stood out to us over the last few months is the fact that social media companies are now doing content moderation. All of a sudden, a lot of the claims that they didn't have the capacity to intervene seem to have dried up as companies crack down on those who are spreading misinformation about the COVID-19 pandemic. To discuss what this tells us about the future of content moderation and the ways that the information environment around COVID and other issues will be shaped by it, I have with me Rohan Seth and Prateek Wagre. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hi, Rohan.
So, Prateek, over to you. Tell us a little bit about what companies are doing new. What's different here?
Sure. And before I start, just one thing to point out, right? Content moderation as such is not necessarily a new thing for them to do. You know, I've quoted this before, but as Tartan Gillespie says, content moderation is the very essence of what platforms offer, but we've started seeing it at a different scale, especially with the coronavirus, right? And when it started off, both, you know, let me take Facebook and Twitter as prime examples for now. When it started off, both of them promised ways to address misinformation, right? So let's look at Twitter. Twitter said things like, they will provide account verification for health organizations. They're going to, you know, they started displaying search prompts, which would give you COVID-19 information. They put up event pages. They launched a know the facts kind of section, right? And they also changed some of their policies on how they deal with unverified claims. They modified their ad policies. They changed the way they define, right, in the context of the coronavirus. And, you know, the final part was that they transitioned some of their moderation to a more algorithmic-based one. Facebook, for its part, did some similar things, right? They had a Get the Facts section. They partnered with as per a Mark Zuckerberg update on Facebook, they partnered with 60 new fact-checking organizations covering 50 languages. And as of last week, they announced a new thing that, you know, that they'll notify you when you've interacted with harmful misinformation. Interaction in that context means if you've liked, shared, or reacted to content, not necessarily if you've just seen it on your newsfeed, right? And they've also said that in the month of March, they said, you know, about 4,000 articles that their fact-checking teams, as a fact-checking partners, found, put labels on 95% of them. In those cases, people didn't go on to view that content. So they certainly are trying to deal with the barrage of misinformation, disinformation, right, in the context of the infodemic, as it's called.
Yeah. So my main takeaway from this, at least in the Indian context, is that I think it's great that Facebook and Twitter are doing a bunch of things regarding misinformation. I think it's long overdue. And it's, I think, the most evident manner in which we see at least Twitter doing this is when you go to the search functionality in Twitter. So there's an option that says COVID-19 and tweets by relevant Indian authorities, right? So it's great that these companies are doing this. My overarching concern about this is that in India, while Facebook and Twitter and Instagram are insanely important as platforms, I think the biggest player here is WhatsApp. And because it's end-to-end encrypted and a whole lot of communication has actually moved there, more so than most other countries in the world. I think it's going to be most interesting to see how WhatsApp basically deals with this misinformation. And because there's challenges on both sides, because WhatsApp itself doesn't know what is being shared on its platform, as well as the users don't always have a means to verify information because there's no one common newsfeed there per se. So it's nice that these companies are taking steps, and it's going to be really interesting to see how, so especially WhatsApp, takes this going forward.
So in the limited context that you can do something on WhatsApp, I think, you know, they have partnered with WHO and they've tried to create these chatbot type of things, right, that will provide you with information.
Yeah.
But yeah, as you said, as an ecosystem, WhatsApp is much trickier to deal with.
Do you guys see room for state intervention here?
From my understanding, it is inherently in WhatsApp as a platform, there is not a lot of, let's say, room in how the state can intervene without, I'd say, significantly altering the nature of the platform itself. So again, as I said, in Twitter or on Facebook or on Instagram, it's a bit easier because there is a common feed where myths can be debunked, and let's say one popular myth has been debunked and it spreads across the feed. It's easier to, you know, curb that information. In WhatsApp, there is no particular feed per se. So it's up short of, let's say, sending a text that this particular fact was false. There's not a lot you can do. But to their credit, I think the WHO is on WhatsApp as a verified entity, as are some Indian departments. So whatever I think can be done at this point is being done. And they're trying to, I think, come up with more, I think, limitations on forwards as well. So a bunch of things are happening, but it's a lot trickier even for the state to intervene because the mechanism to do so doesn't exist. And WhatsApp has been made in a way that sort of inadvertently plugs this whole pandemic into the worst possible case because so many of the Indians communicate on WhatsApp. It's not conducive to state interventions or platform interventions in a general sense.
But just to add to that, right? Even in the open feed format, it's not necessarily that easy. I think there was a study which I think Oxford and Avaaz Foundation did. They took pieces of a sample set of content that had been debunked by fact checkers. I think they found that 60% of it remained up on Twitter. YouTube did better, I think 27%, and Facebook, strangely enough, did the best. Only 24% of them stayed up. So it's a challenge, you know, in all senses of the word.
So let me ask you a little bit about how these companies are actually doing the content moderation, right? Pratik, you mentioned that about 4,000 articles had been flagged by a team of content moderators affiliated with Google. But 4,000 honestly just feels like a drop in the ocean compared to a sheer volume of stuff that the internet's constantly generating, right? So how exactly are companies scaling up to fight this problem, especially considering that a lot of their content moderators, I assume, now have to work from home, can't come into offices and so on?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So in the context of that 4,000 articles, right, the other statistic there was that they displayed warnings on 40 million, right? But just to give you context, I think Facebook releases a quarterly update of how many posts they take down. And I think that as per the latest information, which goes back 1 or 2 quarters, they remove about 12 billion pieces of content per quarter, right, as per that. Now, to your point about algorithmic moderation, right? So, again, Facebook has said it's reducing its reliance on the manual workforce, using more automated moderation. Twitter, in their blog post where they mentioned this, didn't necessarily say they're reducing their reliance, reducing the workforce. They said they're transitioning to work from home and they're going to use more algorithmic moderation, right? It's minor semantics there, but I think the end takeaway is that they are going to use more, there's going to be more algorithmic thing coming up. Now, the problem that poses at this point in time is that we're not going to see the content that, you know, that should have stayed up and has gone down because it's been flagged by the algorithmic content, algorithmic moderation, and not been reviewed by human moderators who would have then taken a call on whether it actually stays up or stays down. Right, and so that's going to remain a challenge, and which is why there's been a call a night before last from about 75 independent researchers and organizations who put out an open letter to social media companies asking them to retain all their information, all their data from from this period, right? And they said that the social media companies have emergency power right now, and they should find a way to retain as much of this information as they can, of course, without violating anyone's privacy, to allow for research post-fact so that people can understand how these policies have affected actual information flows at this time, right? So it's at this point, we're still in the middle of things. It's going to be hard to tell exactly how this algorithmic thing is playing out, right? Interestingly, I think as soon as Facebook made the announcement, they also hit this. I don't know if you guys recall this, but they had a bug with their spam identification system, and a lot of posts started being marked as spam, right? And people said, "Oh, immediately that this is linked to the fact that they're moving to algorithmic moderation." Now, to be fair, we don't know what the actual root cause was. They came out and said it was a bug with their spam filter. which caused a lot of posts to get incorrectly tagged as spam, including some of the, you know, the Kumar Sambhav posts that he had done, the Information Collective, right? The second series that came out, some of those posts were also tagged as spam. So it was interesting to see. But yeah, we'll have to see where this goes. There needs to be future research on this to really understand the implications of algorithmic moderation, because at this point, we don't know. You know, we don't know what we're not seeing.
So the next thing I wanted to ask you guys was actually on the lines of this flow of information, right? So a company called Graphica has recently come out with an analysis of who are the accounts, who are the people that are generally spreading misinformation related to the coronavirus pandemic. And they found that in a lot of countries across the world, it's mostly right-wing accounts that are very well connected to right-wing bubbles of social media that tend to be pushing a lot of disinformation. I mean, they had a very interesting statistic which showed that compared to the left-wing, the American right is putting out about 21% more disinformation about the coronavirus on Twitter. So I wanted to ask you, is the fact that companies are now disproportionately going to have to crack down on right-wing accounts going to change the political environment?
So I see that there's a lot to unpack here, essentially, because, well, let's start with the US, because in just terms of discourse that has developed more than in India, and I think India is going to develop its own discourse in the coming weeks. But what has essentially happened in the US is that earlier, for the most part, the debate on the virus was largely scientific or around the policy measures that were being taken to basically curb the spread. So you would have videos of how Wuhan has been completely locked down, or stuff like whether the virus can transmit through water, right? So it's very pretty binary. You can say, well, it can or it can't, or Wuhan isn't under lockdown or it isn't. At the same time, so Facebook, let's say, would find it easier to eliminate misinformation in that sense. But since I'd say that was 2-3 weeks ago, I honestly don't, I'm not doing well with the concept of time right now. But essentially what has happened is that this whole thing has evolved, and it's because of, let's say, Fox News and a bunch of other media entities that have come up with this now narrative of the cure cannot be better than the disease itself. So it has now sort of fairly divided between partisan lines. So you have a whole bunch of right-wingers saying that it is better to open the country up, and the whole argument that I should be free to do whatever I want and not wear, let's say, a mask in a grocery store and stuff like this. So generally, this is divided amongst party lines in the US, and it's become inherently political. In India, I think it is yet to reach there, but it definitely will. And as you said, Anirudh, we've seen that a lot of right-wing accounts are sharing these tweets a lot more than, let's say, some of the more liberal or left-wing accounts. It's true, because we have seen, just in the context of this virus, right-wing accounts have actually been, like, their whole agenda and propaganda has been such that it comes with more cohesiveness. The idea is that your freedoms have to be respected, and you should be allowed to roam free, you know. It's your country, especially in the US, because as I said, the discourse is far more developed. But yet to see how this will play out in India, because the common messaging, thankfully for India, is that we should still remain under lockdown. It's not so in the US. So that is why I think, it's more, let's say, concentrated the response of the right wing. In India, I think that we will see in the upcoming few weeks, depending on what the political parties say, what the Prime Minister's office says, and of course, what the media decides to accentuate. We're, let's say, 10 days behind the curve in the terms of the media cycle as well. Be a good thumb rule here. So we'll see how that develops.
Actually, I have a slight disagreement with that. So, you know, I think just last week, Anirudh, Manoj and me spoke about some of the information operations that were happening in India. So we're starting to see some of those currents already, right? And this just, but you know, like I said, this just goes to tell you that ultimately everything is political. Initially, this presented a seemingly non-controversial opportunity for platforms to intervene, but we've seen that as it's gone on, it has become politicized. People are continuing to entrench along certain views, right? And I think most recently we've seen with Facebook choosing to take down protest pages for events. I think in the US they were having stay-at-home protests, or they were protesting against the stay-at-home order, rather, and Facebook has taken down some of those event pages. and has not taken down some of those event pages, right? So again, there's that discretion element coming in. I think what they've publicly said is that it depended on whether the gathering was legal or illegal in that particular state, right? And this brings me to an interesting point in the sense that every time, you know, Facebook, Twitter, and I'm taking their names, but essentially all these big tech companies, when every time they announce a policy, I think it's important for us to look at it in the lens of, you know, they might be announcing it with a mainly American or Western European intent. But we have to look at the fact that it has to apply across, you know, 100 plus countries in many, many languages, right? Now, that's not saying that they should never announce new policies. But I think for people who watch these companies, it's important to look at it from that lens for us to be able to identify potential harms and shortcomings in their policy, which is why in India, right? So we've seen some of the politicization happen. None of them have actually put out any numbers. So it's hard to tell how effective this strategy has been with India so far.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a very good point that you've raised, Pratik. The fact that it seems like Facebook really goes out of its way sometimes to understand the legal context within which it's operating when it comes to content moderation in the US and Europe. But in India, even though India has existing laws against hate speech, social media companies don't seem anywhere near as interested as in cutting down misinformation. And I sometimes wonder why this is. The uncharitable part of me would think that it's because it helps get them more engagement, blah, blah, blah. But even in the moment of a pandemic, the fact that this hasn't really materialized makes me think that a lot of this content moderation stuff is meant to play to a Western audience. And there isn't necessarily that kind of seriousness about tackling misinformation in other parts of the world. Why exactly that is, I'm not really sure. And I don't think we know enough to really come to a judgment about that. But I guess that actually brings me to a broader question, right? I mean, Google is very proud about the fact that it's a company that does not do evil, right? Whereas Facebook is a company that that hasn't necessarily shown that same kind of commitment to upholding broader social values, advancing the cause of humanity, as it were. Do you think that responding to this pandemic, do you think that shouldering the responsibility now for potentially deaths in the thousands will change the way that these companies do business? Will it change the way that they approach their responsibility as some of the most powerful organizations in human history?
I think that's a great point that you've brought up, because company culture, I think, is going to matter a lot here. And as you said, Google is an organization that takes pride in the don't be evil symbol. It's the, let's say, spirit behind that motto that has led Google to take some pretty drastic decisions. For some people might not know this, but just the very attitude of being holier than thou at Google, it's the don't be evil motto actually caused Google to pull out of China, which could have been arguably its biggest market if it had, you know, stayed in. But because the Chinese state wanted Google to censor some things and that went against Google's principle, that was one of the key reasons for Google to pull out of a market of a billion people. And so you see how seriously they have basically taken this particular motto in their company's history, right? As opposed to Facebook, where the idea is to get growth at all costs. So you don't always have to be ethically or morally right to achieve that. I'm not passing judgment on whether or not they have been ethically right or morally right. But generally what we've seen is that content that gives more engagement, Facebook is more than happy to promote it. And it's also highly competitive as a company. So just to give you one example, I think it seems like it's been ages now. It's a different lifetime. But when Facebook acquired Instagram, one of the first few meetings that the Instagram founder, Kevin, at the time had was at a lunch with a Facebook team that said that Instagram was acquired and Facebook was now planning to kill Instagram using a project called Facebook Camera. So you just see how competitive this company is and how growth at all costs is just the spirit that drives it. So it's going to be extremely interesting to see how they handle misinformation during the pandemic, because when, you know, more effective measures for content moderation began, as I said, the debate was more or less binary, that this is true and this isn't. But as the debate has gotten more political, Facebook will likely have to manage this trade-off on whether to promote more engagement in content, because I'm sure ad revenues will fall because not a lot of people have money to spend right now. So ad revenues will take a hit. So we will see them managing this trade-off for having more engaging content or being ethically right. And it's anyone's guess as to what value will win over in the coming future. But as of right now, it is near impossible to say. But this trade-off, I think, is something that we should keep an eye on, considering how long this thing might last and the stakes that are very evident here.
That's a nice way of putting it. It's basically, yes, a trade-off between increased engagement in the time of reduced ad revenues and a broader commitment to actually fighting a pandemic as part of humanity, right? Prateek, do you have anything to add here?
Just maybe a slightly a cynical view. I think as it was, I think, Casey Newton in The Verge who said that, you know, because of this, the tech lash, it hasn't stopped, it has just paused, right? So it's going to be interesting to see how, you know, how people view these companies and what they've done now, you know, how they've helped fight the pandemic and, you know, potentially what they've gained from that after we're, you know, once we're past this event. I think that the term that some people are using for these kind of things is corona washing.
Corona washing?
Yeah.
Can you explain that term?
You whitewash certain parts. You're corona washing potentially problematic history by doing something good at this time. Like I said, it's a cynical view.
It is a cynical view, but I mean, I can see there's some merit in it because I see a lot of governments across the world also doing something similar, right? And it's very fascinating to see the kind of push and pull that's happening between social media companies and governments. One interesting thing from the Graphica study that really stood out to me was the fact that across the world, there are very similar narratives being pushed by the right wing. And I think it's important to contextualize them with the fact that a lot of governments across the world now are adopting increasingly nationalist and populist stances and are actively using social media to kind of manipulate domestic public opinion, right? So it's going to be interesting to see whether the censorship of right-wing misinformation, disinformation is actually going to lead to a kind of confrontation happening between tech companies and governments, or whether tech companies are going to end up basically conceding to governments and helping them basically maintain a certain kind of information environment in various countries. And on that extremely optimistic note, I'd like to thank both of you for joining me. And thank you for listening to All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.